Penguin Random House Canada presents The Birth House by Amy McKay. Read for you by Genevieve Steele. Prologue. My house stands at the edge of the earth. Together, the house and I have held strong against the churning tides of Fundy, two sisters stubborn in our bones. My father, Judah Rare, built this farmhouse in 1917. It was my wedding gift. "A strong house for a rare woman," he said. I was 18. He and his five brothers, shipbuilders by trade, raised her worthy from timbers born on my grandfather's land. Oak for stability and certainty, yellow birch for new life and change, spruce for protection from the world outside. Father was an intuitive carpenter, carrying out his work like holy ritual. His calloused hands, veined with pride, had a memory for measure and a knowing of what it takes to withstand the sea. Strength and a sense of knowing. That's what you have to live in the bay. Each morning, you set your sights on the tasks ahead and hope that when the day is done, you're farther along than when you started. Our little village, perched on the crook of God's finger, has always been ruled by storm and season. The men did whatever they had to do to get by. They joked with one another in fire-warmed kitchens after sunset, smoking their pipes, someone bringing out a fiddle, laughing as they chorused, "No matter how rough, we can take it." The seasons were reflected in their faces and in the movement of their bodies. When it was time for the shad, herring, and cod to come in, they were fishermen, dark with tiresome wet from the sea. When the deer began to huddle on the back of the mountain, they became hunters and woodsmen. When spring came, they worked the green-scented earth, planting crops that would keep: potatoes, cabbage, carrots, turnips. Summer saw their weathered hands building ships and haying fields, and sunsets that ribboned over the water, daring the skies to turn night. The long days were filled with pride and ceremony as mighty sailing ships were launched from the shore. The Loretta, the Reward, the Nordica, the Bluebird, the Huntley. My father said he'd scour 200 acres of forest just to find the perfect trees to build a three-masted schooner. Tall yellow birch, gently arched by northwesterly winds, was highly prized. He could spot the keel in a tree's curve and shadow, the return of the tide set in the grain. Men wagered their lives with the sea for the honor of these vessels. Each morning they watched for the signs. Red skies in morning, sailors take warning. Each night they looked to the heavens, spotting starry creatures or the point of a dragon's tail. They told themselves that these were promises from God, that he would keep the wiry cold fingers of the sea from grabbing at them, from taking their lives. Sometimes men were taken. On those dark days, the men who were left behind sat down together and made conversation of every detail, hitching truth to wives' tales while mending their nets. As the men bargained with the elements, the women tended to matters at home. They bartered with each other to fill their pantries and clothe their children. Grandmothers, aunts, and sisters taught one another to stitch and cook and spin. On Sunday mornings, mothers bent their knees between the stalwart pews at the Union Church, praying they would have enough. With hymnals clutched against their breasts, they told the Lord they would be ever faithful if their husbands were spared. When husbands, fathers, and sons were kept out in the fog longer than was safe, the women stood at their windows, holding their lamps, a chorus of lady moons beckoning their lovers back to shore. Waiting, they hushed their children to sleep and listened for the voice of the moon in the crashing waves. In the secret of the night, mothers whispered to their daughters that only the moon could force the waters to submit. It was the moon's voice that called the men home, her voice that turned the tides of womanhood, her voice that pulled their babies into the light of birth. My house became the birth house. That's what the women came to call it, knocking on the door, ripe with child, water breaking on the porch. First-time mothers, full of questions, young girls in trouble, and seasoned women with a brood already at home. I called those babies toesies because they were more than their mamas could count on their fingers. They all came to the house, wailing and keening their babies into the world. I wiped their feverish necks with cool, moist cloths, spooned porridge and hot tea into their tired bodies, talked them back from outside of themselves. Ginny, she had two. Sadie Loomer, she had a girl here. Precious, she had twins, twice. Celia had six boys, but she was married to my brother Albert. Rare men always have boys. Iris Rose, she had Rennie. All I ever wanted was to keep them safe. Part 1. Around the year 1760, a ship of Scotch immigrants came to be wrecked on the shores of this place. Although the vessel was lost, her passengers and crew managed to find shelter here. They struggled through the winter, many taking ill, the women losing their children, the men making the difficult journey down North Mountain to the valley below, carrying sacks of potatoes and other goods back to their temporary home, now called Scott's Bay. In the spring, when all who had been stranded chose to make their way to more established communities, the daughter of the ship's captain, Annie MacIsaac, stayed behind. She had fallen in love with a Mi'kmaq man she called Silent Rare. On the evening of a full moon in June, Silent went out in his canoe to catch the shad that were spawning around the tip of Cape Split. As the night wore on, Annie began to worry that some ill had befallen her love. She looked across the water for signs of him, but found nothing. She walked to the cove where they had first met and began to call out to him, promising her heart, her fidelity, and 1,000 sons to his name. The moon, seeing Annie's sadness, began to sing, forcing the waves inland, strong and fast, bringing Silent safely back to his lover. Since that time, every child born from the rare name has been male, and even now, when the moon is full, you can hear her voice, the voice of the moon, singing the sailor's home. A Rare Family History, 1850. Chapter 1. Ever since I can remember, people have had more than enough to say about me. As the only daughter in 5 generations of Rares, most figure I was changed by fairies or not my father's child. Mother works and prays too hard to have anyone but those with the cruelest of tongues doubt her devotion to my father. When there's no good explanation for something, people of the bay find it easier to believe in mermaids and moss babies, to call it witchery and be done with it. Long after the New England planter's seed wore the Mi'kmaq out of my family's blood, I was born with coal-black hair, cinnamon skin, and a caul over my face. A foretelling. A sign. A gift that supposedly allows me to talk to animals, see people's deaths, and hear the whisperings of spirits. A charm for protection against drowning. When one of Laird Jessop's Highland heifers gave birth to a 3-legged albino calf, talk followed, and people tried to guess what could have made such a creature. In the end, most people blamed me for it. I had witnessed the cow bawling her calf onto the ground. I had been the one who ran to the Jessops to tell the young farmer about the strange thing that had happened. Dora talked to ghosts. Dora ate bat soup. Dora slit the devil's throat and flew over the chicken coop. My classmates chanted that verse between the slats of the garden gate, along with all the other words their parents taught them not to say. Of course, there are plenty of schoolyard stories about Miss B, too, most of them ending with, "If your cat or your baby goes missing, you'll know where to find the bones." It's talk like that that's made us such good friends. Miss B says she's glad for gossip. It keeps folks from coming to places they don't belong. Most days I wake up and say a prayer. I want, I wish, I wait for something to happen to me. While I thank God for all good things, I don't say this verse to him, or to Jesus, or even to Mary. They are far too busy to be worrying about the affairs and wishes of my heart. No, I say my prayer more to the air than anything else, hoping it might catch on the wind and find its way to anything, to something that's mine. Mother says, a young lady should take care with what she wishes for. I'm beginning to think she's right. Yesterday was fair for a Saturday in October. Warm, with no wind and clear
Sample complete. Ready to continue?